So thanks for being here tonight. And this year, as I think most of you know, since you've been coming for a while, we're studying the Four Noble Truths. And this month, our focus is right action or wise action. And we're amazingly over halfway through the month now, which I can almost not quite believe, but it's true. So we've all had some time to reflect on and practice with wise action. And so tonight I wanted to share with you some of the things that I've been thinking about on this topic that have been helpful for me that I've been working with. And later on in the evening after the talk, there'll be some time when, if you would like to share some of what's been going on in your practice, you'll have an opportunity to do that too. So right or wise action can, you know, be a pretty challenging part of this Eightfold Path. On the one hand, it can seem all too familiar, you know, something that we've all heard about before. We hear right action, and often the first thing we think of is, okay, right action, the five precepts: refrain from killing, refrain from stealing, refrain from lying, refrain from intoxicants, refrain from sexual misconduct. Yeah, okay, I know about that. I've heard about that. And I'm pretty good, you know. I could be more careful about this or that, but yeah, I kind of got this. And after that, we're really eager to be getting on to the more exciting topics, you know, the things about meditation and concentration and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, wise action can be really quite difficult and sobering. It's not always a comfortable topic. It's one that we might really not want to go into all that deeply because it might force us to look at some aspects of our conduct or actions that we really would not want to see all that clearly. It might be because we just don't like that image of ourselves doing these things, or maybe because we aren't really ready to go through that hard work of changing what we're doing, so we would rather sort of, you know, keep it over on the side, a little bit out of view. And two, when we think about right action, it's all too easy to see and think of all the actions we do that aren't necessarily right and aren't necessarily wise, and get very self-critical and really discouraged about our practice and doubt our ability to really practice effectively. So it's not easy, and when we're working with wise action, our attitude toward it really is quite important. So as I was getting ready for this talk, I found myself thinking about last year when we were studying, you know, the paramis, and especially the parami of sila, or ethical conduct, which has a lot in common with wise action. And at that time, one of the things that really struck me was what Norman Fisher said about sila, or ethical conduct, in his book on the paramis. He said that it should be a source of joy. And here's what he says about sila, which applies just as well to right action. He says, at first, sila involves some intentional restraint. But as we continue on the path, we easily and spontaneously practice it without noticing. At this point, the perfection of ethical conduct isn't uptight or restrictive. It's a joyful path of doing what comes naturally out of the fullness of the heart. And that just sounds so beautiful, you know, a joyful path of doing what comes naturally out of the fullness of the heart. And then he goes on to say, we don't generally think of ethical conduct that way, as this joyful path. We think of it quite soberly, as a matter of restraint, purification, and righteousness. You follow ethical guidelines to clean up your act, to straighten out your behavior, and to be a decent and good person. And he acknowledges that, you know, yes, those things are an important part of the development of ethical conduct or of wise action, to have some restraint and refrain from behaviors that aren't very wise and that might harm us or others. And yet, he says, the perfection of ethical conduct, like an eagle in flight, soars far beyond conventional ethics into the empty blue skies of love and delight. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't necessarily associate ethical conduct and wise action with love and delight. Like Norman Fisher says, you know, my first impulse is to think more about restraint, you know, cleaning up my act, straightening out my behavior, you know, stopping those things that aren't really what I ought to be doing. So it's definitely more on the sober and serious side and not so much on the joyful side. And Norman Fisher also mentioned in his book that the effort to be morally correct is often associated with righteousness and judgment. And I, and probably you too, can see how this is sometimes true. We can be quite critical, not only of our own conduct, but of other people's conduct too. And when we use these faculties of, you know, critical faculties in our judgment, as wise discernment, so we know if something is skillful or unskillful, that's, you know, actually good and helpful. We need to be able to do that and make those determinations. But when we move on from noting what is skillful and what isn't to judging the person who has performed this maybe skillful or unskillful action, if it's a skillful action, then deciding, oh, I'm a bad person, or, oh, they're a bad person. Well, you know, that's not really very helpful at all, not to us, not to the other people. And it's, you know, a tendency, I think, especially in this very divisive world that we're living in right now, to really kind of guard against this too quickly going from, oh, that's not a very skillful act, to, oh, this person is a bad person. This person is an enemy. So, not so helpful when we get overly critical and judgmental. So for me, it's really been sort of a practice. I think I did this with the Paramis, with Sila, and also now with Wise Action, to really consciously try to shift my focus from thinking about wise action, not so much as this set of rules that we need to follow, and if we don't follow it, we're good, and if we don't follow it, we're bad, and if we do follow it, we're good, and more as behavior that arises naturally out of wisdom and love. And so over this month, I've really been appreciating all of this very detailed work we've been doing on the Four Noble Truths and especially on the Eightfold Path, because it's really helped me to see how wise action fits within that larger context. And it's something that follows very naturally from wise intention and wise view. If we have wise view, then we understand that our actions have consequences. Some of them lead to suffering. Some of them lead to freedom of suffering, from suffering. And if we find that we're doing things out of greed, out of anger, if we're all caught up in confusion and delusion and we start acting out of that, then consequences aren't going to be so good. On the other hand, if we're motivated by generosity and kindness and clarity, consequences are going to be a lot better. So it really just makes sense to do those things that, as Ajahn Suchito says, are for our benefit, for the benefit of others, and that lead to peace. It just makes sense. Wise action just makes sense. And with wise intention, our actions are grounded in kindness and non-harming and restraint. And so we do what we do because we have that kind of intention in our mind. We care about our welfare. We care about the welfare of others. And this kind of view really fits very well with what Norman Fisher talks about, describing ethical conduct as a joyful path of doing what comes naturally out of the fullness of the heart. Now, as Tim has discussed over the past couple of weeks in the really clear and great talks he has been giving, a big part of this joyful path is restraint. Restraining ourselves from actions that will cause harm to ourselves and to other beings. So we practice the precepts as best we are able. We train to refrain from killing other living beings, from saying what isn't true, from taking what isn't freely given, from the misuse of intoxicants, and from sexual misconduct. And now, just doing just these things, actually, that's no small thing. If everyone in the world adhered to the precepts, even in just the most very, very basic way, you know, not killing other people, not lying, not stealing, not abusing drugs or alcohol, not sexually exploiting and abusing other people, just on the very most basic level, that alone would eliminate just so much suffering in the world, an incredible amount of suffering. And if we're doing these basic things, we can also go even deeper into the precepts, as Tim has been talking about in these past weeks. We can do things like refraining from taking not only material possessions from others, but refrain from taking up too much of their time, their opportunity to speak and be seen, and so forth. Or we can take greater care with other forms of life so we don't harm them or kill them. We can notice the times when we don't lie exactly, but we exaggerate or distort the truth, maybe to entertain people or make ourselves look a little bit better. And that's always all really good stuff, really good things to do. But wise action isn't only about restraint. It's also about doing what is beneficial and cultivating the good. And we see this in some definitions of wise action that our various teachers have offered. For example, in his book, Dancing with Life, Philip Moffat says that wise action is any action that liberates the mind, moves you toward freedom from suffering, and supports a feeling of well-being that is independent of external conditions. So this really encompasses potentially a lot of things. Yeah, restraint, yes, but many other things. And Bhikkhu Bodhi defines wise action as actions that are motivated by wholesome intentions and lead to the well-being of oneself and others, ultimately paving the way to the cessation of suffering or dukkha and the attainment of liberation, or nibbana. And the Buddha himself gave this advice. He says, when you know for yourselves these qualities are skillful, blameless, praised by the wise, when these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. So all of these definitions encouraging us to not only restrain from harmful things, but also cultivate good and beautiful and useful things. So when we think about wise action, we can think not only of what we should refrain from, but all the kind, loving, and beneficial actions that we can do and that we should do. It's kind of like if you're trying to improve your diet and eat in a more healthy way. you know, most definitely you need to recognize the foods that aren't very healthy and avoid those kinds of foods. But it's also important to think about all the good things that you can have and that you should have. You know, thinking about all the beautiful produce you might find at the farmer's market or things that are growing in your garden. Focusing all the time on, I shouldn't do this and I can't have that. You know, that's kind of depressing and discouraging. And so it can really motivate us to consider the positive aspects as well. So in the guidance for wise speech, we're told what we should avoid. False speech, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle chatter, or frivolous speech. And we're also told what we should cultivate. Speech that is true, speech that is kind, that's beneficial, speech that's timely, so it's said at an appropriate time when the person who's receiving it can actually take it in. When it comes to our actions, of course, the five precepts give us great guidelines on what we should avoid. And as for what we should cultivate, in a lot of ways, the guidance for wise speech applies for actions too. We can cultivate actions that are kind, that are beneficial, that are useful, that are timely, and that are truthful and honest in the sense that we're doing them in a sincere way and we don't have some kind of ulterior motives for doing these actions. And we also get a sense of what we should cultivate from the precepts. And in a version of the precepts that we often use at Seattle Insight, when we take the precepts at the beginning of the year, it lays out both the refrain and the cultivation. I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all living beings. I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. I undertake the training to refrain from intoxicants that lead to carelessness. And I vow to ingest items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. So this can be a nice way of thinking about the precepts. You know, the refraining part is very good, but there are times when considering this positive viewpoint is also really helpful and really useful. The Mahamangala Sutta, or the Sutta on the Greatest Blessings, is another teaching that gives us a sense of the wise actions we can take that are blessings, blessings for ourselves and blessings for those around us. And some of these actions are encouragements to restraint, but many of them are positive sorts of wholesome actions too. And so I'd like to read you this sutta so you get a sense of these different beautiful and wholesome actions that are blessings. So this is the sutta. Thus I have heard, on one occasion, the Exalted One, the Buddha, there is who they're referring to, was dwelling at Anapadinka's monastery in Jetta's Grove near Savatthi. Now when the night was far spent, a certain deity, whose surpassing splendor illuminated the entire Jetta Grove, came to the presence of the Exalted One, and drawing near, respectfully saluted him and stood at one side. Standing thus, he addressed the Exalted One in verse. Many deities and men, yearning after good, have pondered on blessings. Pray, tell me the greatest blessing. And this is what the Buddha told him. Not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise, and to honor those who are worthy of honor. This is the greatest blessing. To reside in a suitable locality, to have done meritorious actions in the past, and to set oneself in the right course. This is the greatest blessing. To have much learning, to be skillful in handicraft, well-trained in discipline, and to be of good speech. This is the greatest blessing. To support mother and father, to cherish spouse and children, to be engaged in peaceful occupation. This is the greatest blessing. To be generous in giving, to be righteous in conduct, to help one's relatives, and to be blameless in action. This is the greatest blessing. To loathe more evil and abstain from it, to refrain from intoxicants, and to be steadfast in virtue. This is the greatest blessing. To be respectful, humble, contented, and grateful, and to listen to the Dhamma on due occasion. This is the greatest blessing. To be patient and obedient, to associate with monks, and to have religious discussions on due occasions. This is the greatest blessing. Self-restraint, a holy and chaste life, the perception of the noble truths, and the realization of Nibbana. This is the greatest blessing. A mind unruffled by the vagaries of fortune, from sorrow freed, from defilements cleansed, from fear liberated. This is the greatest blessing. Those who thus abide ever remain invincible in happiness established. These are the greatest blessings. So you can see from this sutta that there are all kinds of things we can do that the Buddha considered as wise actions and as blessings. These include things like associating with wise people that have a positive influence, living in a suitable location that supports you and your spiritual practice. And for you, you know, maybe this is a little cootie out in the forest, but it might just as well be a home that's clean and uncluttered, or a home that doesn't require a lot of time and money to maintain, or one that's quiet and peaceful. You have a sense of that yourself. Having a good education and a skillful profession is a blessing. So this really emphasizes the value of knowledge and practical skills in one's life. Caring for one's family, one's parents, and one's relatives. Being able to do that really is a blessing. Practicing generosity and behaving ethically. Developing patience, humility, gratitude, and contentment. You know, I'm thinking another way of saying this might be developing the paramis that we spent last year working on. So working with those beautiful qualities and developing them is a real blessing. Studying and practicing the Dharma. Developing a stable and peaceful mind through meditation and having contact with and guidance from monastics and other spiritual teachers, those are blessings. And then, of course, understanding the Four Noble Truths and realizing Nibbana, or freedom from suffering. So I found that it really helps me to remember when I'm doing these things. These really are wise actions, and it's inspiring to think of them too, you know, and think of, you know, what might I do that would be wise and beneficial? Today, what would be a wise and good action? And I remember a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, Tim told a story about Joseph Goldstein. So when Joseph was feeling discouraged and upset about his practice, his teacher encouraged him to reflect on his actions with the idea that if he reflected on his wholesome actions, that would cheer him up and brighten his mind. Well, Joseph didn't quite understand these instructions, so he went away and he reflected on all of his unwise actions and everything he could think of that he didn't do quite right, and so he felt even worse. But if we actually, you know, recognize, actually do the teacher, what the teacher advised in the way the teacher advised, and recognize and reflect on our wise actions, I think it really can be a help for us. You know, not in the sense of feeling like, oh wow, I'm so great, I'm so virtuous, you know, not like that, but more in the sense of recognizing that we actually can do things that are kind and beneficial. Because sometimes, you know, we kind of feel like we really can't do very much. If we see that we can, that really is helpful. And when we realize that, and when we feel the joy that doing something good and useful can bring, you know, that gives us motivation. We feel like we want to keep on doing those things, maybe do more of those things. And also we can appreciate the fact that when we act wisely, this really frees us of the painful burden of guilt and regret that we have to carry when we're doing actions that are not so wise and that cause harm. So being free of that is really a great blessing. So when we practice wise action, we practice restraint, and we also cultivate the good. There's one other thing that I wanted to mention tonight, and this is the fact that unwise action may not only be what we do, but what we don't do. This came up in our teacher's discussion with our Sunday teaching group when we were planning the Sunday Sit, and it's something that stuck with me over the past weeks and that I've been thinking about. The fact that sometimes our unwise actions aren't the actions themselves, but our failure to act, the times when we don't do what would be useful and beneficial. And when we think about this, I think probably our tendency is what first comes to mind are these really big things that we avoid doing, because a lot of times we aren't really sure how to do them or what the wisest action would be. These might be things like addressing some conflict in our family or at work, or maybe trying to figure out the best political actions or social actions that we should undertake that would actually be helpful and not increase divisiveness. And it's important for us to think about these kind of situations and to consider the wisest course of action that we could take. And, you know, a whole evening's talk and more could be devoted to this. When he talks about wise action, Philip Moffat notes that it arises out of clear comprehension, meaning that you're clear about what's needed, what's appropriate, and what's doable within your limitations. And those three are all very good advice to keep in mind when we're thinking about these difficult situations, although often there aren't really any easy answers about what is wise in complex times and things. But there are lots of situations in our lives that really aren't very big, and they aren't very difficult, and where the wise thing to do is pretty clear, not so hard to figure out, and yet still we don't act. And these are often, you know, very ordinary, mundane kinds of things, you know, things like going to the gym or cleaning the house or maybe making sure you take time for your daily sit, you know, actions that we know are beneficial to do, but sometimes we just don't quite get around to them. And I admit that I have plenty of those kind of situations myself where I don't do what I probably should do or what I intend to do, but instead I delay, I procrastinate, I put it off. You know, sometimes this is because I really don't have the time to do this thing or because it's not the right time to do it. Sometimes that is actually true, but a lot of the time it's more because I just don't really feel like doing that thing. It's kind of unpleasant, even though I know it's good for me. Or I'm afraid that if I do it, it's not going to go right, I won't do it well enough, I'm going to make a mess of it. All that kind of stuff causes me to avoid. Doubt, worry, fear, aversion, sometimes just plain laziness. All those things get in the way of doing what I know I ought to do. And I think probably a lot of you can relate to that same kind of situation. So this is one area I've been working on, this tendency to not do what I know would be beneficial to do. And as I was thinking about this, it occurred to me that often instead of doing what would be beneficial to do, I do something else, some kind of distraction, something that's not necessarily harmful, but then, you know, it isn't really all that beneficial either. And in the guidance for wise speech, we're encouraged to say what is beneficial and to avoid frivolous speech, speech that's silly and pointless and is really just kind of a waste of time. And I think it can be sort of the same way with actions. There may be times when we should do what is beneficial and avoid what we might think of as frivolous actions. And the five precepts don't really address this, although in the eight precepts, which we might sometimes take, you know, when we're on a retreat situation, the seventh precept talks a little bit about this frivolous action, saying here we're encouraged to refrain from dancing, singing, music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, using perfumes, beautifying the body with cosmetics. And, you know, we wouldn't generally consider any of these things harmful necessarily, but they could definitely be distractions. You might call them frivolous. And definitely they're not the kinds of things you would want to be doing on retreat. Not that you have that much opportunity to do them on retreat. So, you know, they're things to avoid when you really have something better to spend your time on and they kind of get in the way. And in our everyday lives as lay people, we have plenty of opportunities for doing these things, for singing and dancing and listening to and playing music and going to see entertainments and for a whole host of similar kinds of activities that in the Buddha's day, they wouldn't even imagine that these would be possible. And there are lots of times when doing these things is completely appropriate. If we feel tired and stressed and need some relaxation and downtime, maybe that's a good time to do these things. Or if we just want to do something that's light and fun by ourselves or maybe with family and friends, maybe these sort of activities are just what we need. But then there are times when they really aren't what we need and they really are distracting and frivolous actions. And I've been thinking for myself of frivolous actions as the kinds of kind of mindless and not especially useful activities that I often do when I want to avoid doing something that I probably should be doing. You know, like maybe playing some game on the computer or reading a trashy novel or scrolling through the news feed on my phone one more time, even though there isn't anything new to see, or binge watching some show, you know, all of those kind of things. I think we all have our favorites, maybe other ones that I haven't even mentioned. And it isn't that these frivolous activities are so bad in themselves. The problem is when they get in the way of our doing something that really would be useful and beneficial and when we use them to avoid and procrastinate. And so I've been trying to pay a special attention to this because I feel like I do get into trouble in this area. You know, fairly often when I start doing one of these kinds of activities, I've been trying to ask myself, you know, is this really helpful to be doing right now? Sometimes it's just fine, but other times there are much better ways I could be spending my time. And I've also been asking myself, why are you doing this? What are you trying to put off? What are you trying to avoid? And often, there was something going on like that. It wasn't just that I felt the need for a break. There was something I didn't want to do. Over the past few days, I have to admit that more than once I'd find myself picking up a novel or checking my phone, and then I'd think, oh, you're just putting off working on that talk that you had to give tonight at Sims. So, yeah, because I was anxious, nervous, not sure it would be good enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the reasons why we kind of avoid doing things. And so my first impulse when I saw that procrastination going on was to say to myself, okay, just stop right there, go do what you have to do and get it done. But lately I've been thinking that maybe this is a little bit too quick of action, and that it might be a good time to actually take a pause when I realize I'm doing this. You know, to take a little time to recognize the feelings that are behind that avoidance and acknowledge them. You know, is there fear or anxiety? Maybe there's some kind of a delusion that's feeding these feelings, some story about how I can't do this, or some story about all the things that could go wrong, some story that, you know, isn't necessarily based in the truth at all, but more in kind of catastrophic thinking. And if I see these things and recognize these things, then I can change course with clearer understanding and maybe not get caught up quite so much. So that's another aspect to think about when we're working with wise action. And I'd like to end the talk this evening by emphasizing how important it is, as we're doing this work with wise action, to really keep metta, kindness, front and center. Metta for others, of course, that's really important because kindness is what motivates wise action. But even more than that, sometimes we need metta for ourselves, because it's so easy when we're working on these things to become self-critical and to have unrealistic expectations of what we should be able to do. So unrealistic that we become discouraged and doubtful and, you know, we don't even want to try. And then when we get into that kind of a mood, all too quickly our efforts at wise action become a burden and a source of self-judgment, not a joy at all. So we really need kindness, we really need patience, and we really need a sense of balance. It's important to bring a sincere effort to this work, but at the same time it's helpful not to get so anxious about doing everything perfectly all the time, because we won't, we can't, we aren't perfect. We're human beings, so we do the best we can, and we learn from our mistakes. And that in itself is wise action. So thank you all for your kind attention this evening. I appreciate you being here and listening. And now we have some time for any comments that you may have about how you have been working with wise action, or any questions you may have. So this is your time to share and to speak if you would like to do that. And we have the microphone for the people in the room here. And then I think the people in the Zoom world, they can raise their virtual hands and I can see them and let them speak. But maybe it looks like we have somebody from the room that wants to speak, so maybe we'll start there.
This happened the other day, and I'm still thinking about it. So it was maybe less right action, but less reaction on my part. I live on a one-way street, and it's under construction, so there's a lot of traffic. And I'm walking, and there are two Washington State Patrol cars. They've got their lights and siren on. They've got to get through 8 or 10 cars, and it's crowded. So what happens is they keep moving forward, but the person in the front of the line is this gray-haired lady in a mini compact, tiny little car. She gets to the very front. There are no other cars, not any cars coming the wrong way, not any on the cross street. There are no other cars. She stops at the red light. She stops, and she stays stopped. So she's got this state patrol car right on her bumper and another one right behind it, and she continues to stop until that light turns green, and then she moves away, and I'm thinking, like, I'm not going to react. She doesn't need my opinion.
So she has her idea of right action, and she's going to follow it. Come hell or high water. Yeah, that's kind of funny.
I thought so.
It sort of shows, you know, you can't always. The letter of the law isn't always quite. Yeah, poor woman. And there was no place for her to move over either, huh?
She could put her foot on the accelerator and go.
Well,
go
true.
Through that light and pull over. And then the road is under construction, so it's
so
been
they
narrowed.
Can't get in there anyway. Yeah.
It's been narrowed, so there's like fewer places to go. There's nobody on the cross streets.
Yeah. Well, that might be a good lesson to us to consider, you know. Don't be always so rigid in your thinking when it comes to wise action. Thank you. It's a funny story. Let's see. Do we have anyone else? Okay, a couple of people. And we'll have a couple of these people here, and then we can see if there's any Zoom room people.
Thank you for the talk. My question had to do with, so it seemed like a lot of the talk was sort of from an individual perspective, or like a single person. Mm-hmm. And it's just living in this world today, it really doesn't seem like one person is equal to the other. And so, like, there's some people that have so much power that when they do the wrong action, it has such a like huge effect. So like on the one hand, I understand what you're saying, that like individual people should try to be better, but I guess the part I'm having trouble with is like that it seems to be decontextualized from the power that each person has and how that amplifies their actions. And
so, yeah, well, yeah. What you say is true, you know. Yeah, what you say is true, that there are people they have so much power that their actions, whether for good or ill, have a really outsized influence on everything that goes on in our world and many, many of the people around them, not just those in their immediate sphere. And so I think that's a really good point. Although at the same time, there may be limits on what we can, there are some things that we may be able to do about that situation when people with that much power are doing harmful actions, you know, protests, voting, so and so. But sometimes it's hard to know what the best thing to do is. And I think ultimately, well, what you say is very true. In our own lives, we may only be able to control our own actions. And if we aim our own actions towards the good, that in itself will bring about good outcomes. But I understand your concern. I don't have a really good answer or solution, except to say that there's a limit of our sphere of influence, but we can't always influence what other people will do, but we can influence what we will do. So we can always work there. But thank you for bringing that up. That's a good point for reflection. And I think, you know, in a larger conversation on wise action, more in the social context, I think it would be a really good discussion point. So thank you.
I wanted to say that I guess over the past month with Wise Action, I had kind of been thinking about similar things, like around like environmental action, like that's one I struggle with, like a mm-hmm. feeling like it doesn't matter what personal actions I take, that that's such a big issue that's like out of my control, that there's no yeah. way I'm gonna mm-hmm. affect things. And one of the things that's, or if I, you know, reduce like my meat consumption, I'm not going to fix factory farming. But one of the things that's been helpful for me is kind of to shift from just thinking about wise actions in terms of the outcome and not thinking that my goal is necessarily to fix anything, but to live in a way that's like aligned with my values mm-hmm. and that regardless of what happens, like I'm choosing not to cause harm. I'm choosing not to contribute to harm, like for my own inner state mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. as a personal practice. And then practicing like non-attachment to the outcome, and that I can, you know, be like, if I'm interacting with another person, I can be as good as I want with you. I can do all the aspects of wise speech and try to be as positive of a healing influence, but the other person won't always necessarily receive that, and they may hate you still or something yeah. like that. That the mm-hmm. outcome is just out of our control, and it's like our own personal practice. That's been helpful for me.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's a really good thing for all of us to remember in this, that, you know, we can, just as you were saying, to live with our own values and do the best we can to be kind and to do what is beneficial. But ultimately, you're right. We can't always control the outcome. We want a good outcome. And there's sort of a karmic sense in good intentions and good actions move towards the good, although we can't always know how they move towards the good, you know. But you're right. You can't always fix things. You can't all, and just because you don't necessarily see the result you would want, you don't know that what you have done hasn't actually done real benefit to someone. So I really appreciate you bringing that point up, and I think that's a good reminder, good lesson for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Is there anybody? Oh, yes, you had your hand up before. Let's go here first, and then I will see if there's any Zoom hands. I haven't seen Zoom hands, but...
Thank you for the talk. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really good.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about when we think about right action, it's really easy to start thinking in terms of skillfulness and unskillfulness. Like every part of our lives is a sequence of decisions that are either skillful or unskillful, that either lead to optimal happiness or that are suboptimal. And so it can start becoming really anxiety-inducing. Of just like, yes. I have to make the most skillful actions at all times.
Yes, right.
And so when you talked about like right action should be something that comes from the goodness of our heart, and it should be something joyful. I'm just wondering, how would you recommend transitioning from this anxious attempt of predicting the outcome of every action that you make to this heart-driven kind of impulsive right action?
That is a very good question. That is a very good question. And I think I'm trying to make that transition myself in my own practice, in my own life. And I think what you were describing, that anxiousness of worrying about, am I doing it right? You know, it's very easy to fall into that kind of mindset when we're thinking about right action. And I think that, you know, people, especially if you're a very conscientious sort of person, you know, it can just be drive you crazy, you know, and you get so into analyzing every little thing and didn't, was that quite right or should it, you know, to the point where it's just like you're going nuts, you know. So it's, but I think that is not the approach that we want to take. But I think it helps me to just have that sense of in mind of how this wise action comes out of kindness and metta. And ideally, tempered with wisdom, you know, understanding what we do and, you know, understanding that we don't have as much control as we think. And just sort of keeping that vision in my mind helps me. So when I start to get overly caught up in analyzing and worrying and thinking that it's not enough and not good enough, I sort of pause and step back and kind of think, okay, remember the metta for the others and for myself. But I think it takes a lot of reminding oneself, putting that sense of kindness to the fore and bringing it up over and over again, and gradually the view shifts, I think. It seems to. I'm hoping. I feel like for me it has shifted somewhat just from the fact of recognizing that it's possible to have this very anxious and critical or even sometimes rebellious attitude towards wise action. And it's also possible to have this sense of it as something that arises naturally out of the fullness of one's heart and one's caring. And then I can choose the fullness of one's heart and one's caring. It's a process. So I that's what I feel. I feel like if you have the sense that is the way to go, to just bring it up in your mind, think about it, orient yourself that way. And I think it will make a difference. You know, we're kind of all on the road toward in doing that. So thanks. But that's a really good question, because the tendencies to be anxious and critical about all this is so easy.
Thank you.
Let's see, is there anybody that has a question on Zoom that would like to say anything? I don't see hands, but okay, there's a hand in the room, though. It looks like we have a lot of hands in the room. Okay, go ahead.
Just very briefly on the topic. A few weeks ago, there was a gal here, and she raised the question of what would love do?
Ah, yes.
Which I think is a good, you know, it's just like just a way of entering the fullness of the heart.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really beautiful question. In our Sunday sit, somebody raised that same question, said that they had been encouraged to ask that question when they were on retreat, and we all felt like, yeah, that is a really good question when we're contemplating wise action. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for that great Dharma talk.
Thank you.
I do want to recognize all the people who are the assistant teachers, because you guys do such a wonderful job. I want to be great. I'm very grateful to have younger people in the Sangha asking these questions, because I want to say, at 71, I'm still saying, what would be the wisest course of action? And that really is the big question all the time in life. Am I doing the right thing? Is this the right thing? And I've come to the decision that, or the perspective on many days of, there is very little that I have control over except my mind and my behavior. And my behavior, of course, starts in my mind. And I'm just very grateful to be here and hear these three people ask wonderful things. Oh, I know what I did. the thing about homelessness, I have such a, I want that solved. I don't want to be involved in the solution. And how dare these people? I have all the things that we have in our culture. And somebody who's a political person said the other day, when did we normalize walking past people who are like this? Mm-hmm. And it is, I just do it myself. And I think, what are we doing? What does that require of us? Anyway, I'm rambling.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. I mean, there are so many actions like things like that where it's so overwhelming that we choose not to see. Yeah. I think some of those are the most challenging situations where we are so confused and overwhelmed and don't know what to do that we just shut down. And, you know, there's a lot of that. I mean, I kind of notice it in myself listening to the news. There's a part of me that's, yeah, okay. It just doesn't want to hear anymore. So, yeah, I think that's it. That's something we really all have to work with to maintain our sensitivity when it's taxed to the extreme.
So I wanted to thank you for the talk and also for the point you made about procrastination.
Oh, yes.
So recently I had a situation like that, which was pretty severe. And I went to the oracle of ChatGPT.
Oh.
What should I do? And I actually made a very practical suggestion, which is break it down into smaller pieces, and then it'll become much more approachable. And I did that, and it worked perfectly. But I really like the point you made about, like, ask yourself, why are you doing this? Why is this happening? And I really, really appreciated that, especially after that experience, which was practical, but it kind of went around the core thing, which is, I was doing this because I was really concerned about doing, like a lot of the things that you mentioned, I was really concerned about doing a bad job, not good enough job, and how much depends on this, and da-da-da-da-da. And if I had kind of like reflected on that and worked through it, I think I would have been able to, you know, move forward faster and in a better way. So thank you for pointing that out.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's that procrastination, boy. I really find that it's a challenge, and you know, as you say, breaking it down, doing a little bit. I try that too. I'll just work on it for 5 minutes, and then I can go do something else. And it does kind of help. And you know, I'm still working on understanding the feelings, but I think some of these things, it really takes a lot of patience because they're very deep-seated attitudes, and you know, you keep noticing it, you keep working on it. It gets better. Oh, okay. Let's see. Kathy, go ahead, please. You're muted.
Okay.
Oh, good. Okay. Great.
Sorry. Thank you very much. Your talk has so many rich little places in it. I've enjoyed the comments so much too. Really helpful. And I love the question, why am I doing this? This is just going to be super useful to me. And I wanted to go back and just get you to maybe say a little more or make sure I've got the name right of a Norman Fisher book you referred to, Lyndall, about the...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what... is that the name of it? Will I just look it up and find it that way?
Yeah. That's right. Suze was just saying it's on our website. I forget the title of it.
Okay.
But it's on our website as resources. If you go back to the resources from last year for the Paramis, it's on the name of the book, title of the book is on our website. Yeah, it's a really good book. It doesn't cover all 10 because in the Zen they don't have as many, but he has a lot of really good things to say. So it's a great book.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Thank you, Linda. I also wanted to say that I really appreciated what you were saying about asking the question about, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I taking this action? And sort of leaning into it with curiosity. I just had an experience with this a couple of weeks ago, and it was actually after one of Tuari's talks, and she was talking about anger and how she deals with that sort of emotion. And I was saying, you know, my anger's not really my thing. Mine is craving stuff. And she was saying, well, you know, lean into that with curiosity. And just ask yourself, you know, why is what I'm having not enough? And that very night, drove home from Sims, and I'm sitting there on the couch, and I'm having a piece of cake. I'm eating cake, and I'm like, okay, I'm so tired. I'm going to go to bed after I finish this cake. And then the next thing I know, I'm watching a YouTube video. And I'm sitting there watching this YouTube video, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to bed after this YouTube video. And then the next thing I know, I'm playing a game on my phone. And that's the point when I'm like, what is going on? Like, why am I not going to bed? Mm-hmm. And then I remembered, like, okay, curiosity. Like, what is going on here? Like, why am I craving more time up doing things? And I realized, well, if I go to bed, then I'm going to go to sleep, and then I'm going to wake up. And I was going through a lot of very difficult things with my work, and I realized it means I have to go back to work and do all that hard stuff all over again. So this was all just a way of just putting off having to face this thing that was hard for me for other reasons. Mm-hmm. So like taking actions that weren't sort of thoughtful or skillful just by default because I'm putting off other things. So asking those leaning into curiosity is just such really good advice. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's really funny how so often so much of this really is this kind of avoidance. Yeah, and even sometimes when we realize we're doing it, it's not easy to stop doing it. But yeah, thank you for sharing.
I have a question, actually.
Okay.
you've mentioned a lot of situations where maybe we don't have like a lot of power, or we don't have like a lot of control. However, there certainly are instances where you do have power and control of the outcome, and your decision can cause harm. And I'm curious how you practice with such scenarios where maybe you're not entirely sure what the right action is, and your action has meaningful effect.
That's a difficult question.
Yeah. maybe it's not answerable.
Very difficult question. Well, I would think, you know, just consider, you know, what is your intention in this situation, and making sure that the intention is really for the benefit of everybody involved, and try to see as clearly as you can, you know, what's going on, what's happening, what's really happening. If you're not sure and you can find out more, you can maybe do that before you act.
Yeah, it would put you on the spot there.
Yeah, I know. And maybe you're not sure, but you have good intentions and you're doing the best that you can in that situation. So give it a try and see what happens, you know. Or if you're so unsure that you really don't think it's going to help, and it's better to wait, you can wait. I think it's not easy to give any pat answer. There isn't really a pat answer, but, you know, really thinking about intention, towards what is beneficial, thinking about clarity, understanding the limits of what you're able to do, and acting out of that, and hope that the outcome will produce something good, even if it isn't exactly the way that you wanted it to be. And then maybe too, considering that if it doesn't go right, is the harm going to be greater than the potential good? Maybe you shouldn't act, you know. So that's not a very clear answer, but I think that's about the best answer I can give, because it's really hard to know in a situation like that. It's really challenging. It is very challenging.
Yeah.
But good for us practice, to be thinking about
it. I say practice very purposefully there.
Yes, yeah. It is practice.
But I appreciate the words.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. Okay, first I just want to say I'm totally anxious, like, sharing this group, because I've never been here before. I've been here like two other times, I haven't shared or anything.
Oh, good for you.
Thanks.
You.
But I participate in another gathering. It's like we get together a couple times a week, and there's like 60 people online. It's all around the world, right? Mm-hmm. And then we come into small groups to support each other. And so like maybe a month and a half ago, I was paired with this woman, and I was like, I was excited to work with her because I think she's really smart and really beautiful and, you know, whatever. And as we're speaking, I'm like, trying to act in metta, right? And just allowing space. And so we talk with each other for a certain amount of time, and then we have a debrief. And during the debrief, she's like, that was really boring. And I felt really critical. And I'm like, oh. And so I just like kind of held space for that too.
Mm-hmm.
And it ate at me for maybe a couple of weeks, really. And then later, maybe it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, I got set in a group with her again, and she said, Sherry, do you remember when we were in a group, you know, back some time ago? And I'm like, yeah, I totally do.
Yeah.
She said, over time, she was reflecting on that and can see how it was so helpful to her, because she had to move through something and she needed the space to feel that, you know, feel whatever it was that, you know, I just gave her space for. And I just wanted to reflect on that, because it's like, in the time, it seemed like that was really bad. But over, you know, as time progressed, it was something different. So I really appreciate how we can say wise effort or wise action instead of right.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like, we don't know what's going to unfold. And people are so complex. There's so many issues, so I decided to share that.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. You know, it just sort of shows that we can't always be sure the outcome, and sometimes it's much better than we think. But I agree about the words right action sometimes don't sit well with me, because it makes it sound like there's one right thing to do, when actually there might be various options, which all could be wise. Thank you for your story. And maybe, Deb, you can be the last one, and then it's maybe about time to...
I've just been thinking a lot about Joanna Macy, a lot.
Oh, yes.
Joanna Macy, and that we never know what's going to happen. So the outcome of what we do is, we never know the outcome. We just try to act in a way that creates the least amount of suffering, and just working on our vision of if we work out of our what we seems to us to be right thought, to be right action, but to not let the possibility of failure keep us from doing what we need to do.
Thank you. That's a really great note to actually end the evening on, is to maybe take inspiration from Joanna Macy and don't let our uncertainty stop us from acting in ways that we know are intentions for good. So thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. And I really appreciate all your great questions and sharing and discussion. It was a really nice discussion tonight. And are there any announcements tonight? Is this an announcement night or not? I'm kind of thinking maybe no, but...